Bevor es gleich weitergeht, kommen wir zum Werbepartner der heutigen Folge, und zwar ist das Wanta. Wanta ist der Partner vor allem für SaaS-Unternehmen, die also Software as a Service anbieten. Egal ob als junges Startup oder in der Wachstumsphase, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Wanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 8000 globale Unternehmen nutzen Wanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachweisen zu können. Erhalten Sie ein individuelles Angebot und sichern Sie sich einen Rabatt von $1000 unter wanta.com/missionmoney. Nochmal zum Mitschreiben, langsam unter vanta.com/missionmoney gibt es $1000 Rabatt. Den Link gibt es natürlich auch in der Episodenbeschreibung. Und jetzt viel Spaß beim Podcast der Mission Money.
Why do central banks want the inflation to be 2%? Why not 4% or no percent when the stock market's been going up on a global basis? You have never, ever, ever had a global recession. We're not there yet. So I believe the bull market probably continues. America has a lot less debt than it used to have. But let me just say this really simply. And when I say this, there's probably some of your listeners that are going to immediately turn off the rest of the podcast.
Servus und herzlich willkommen in einem neuen Video, heute mit einem wirklichen Special Guest. Das kann man an der Stelle sagen, er ist eine Investment-Legende, einer der ganz großen Vermögenswalter in den USA, und er war auch schon ein paar Mal zu Gast, und jetzt ist er wieder hier in München, back in Munich. It's a great pleasure. Welcome to the channel again, Ken Fischer.
Thanks for having me. Nice to be with you, Peter.
It's great to have you here in Munich. Last year we talked, I think it was in December 2023.
I lose track of time.
Online. We talked, of course, a little bit about the presidential election, and talked about that these election years are normally relatively good years for stock market. So it was. Now we are in front 2 weeks until the election. Is there a scenario for this election you're worried about for the stock market?
No, not terribly. Let me make a couple of points on that.
Yes, please.
First, the way people think, they tend to have a bias that if their side doesn't win, it's going to be just terrible. Mm-hmm. And they can't quite get over that. But in the beginning of an election year, and we would have talked about this last December, you don't quite know who the candidates will finally be. There's a lot of people saying, extreme things, trying to attract a base. Yeah. You go through the season in America of the primaries, and you winnow down to where you finally get to where there appear to be two candidates. Some uncertainty has fallen. Then you move to where the candidates pick their vice presidential running mates, and you have the conventions, and they establish policies. Some uncertainty falls. Markets like falling uncertainty, and you tend to get irregularly falling uncertainty all the way, not only through the election, but after the election, as the victor picks the beginning of its cabinet, and you begin to see what a government looks like, and you also know what you didn't before, how the congressional elections come out. Yeah. All of that provides falling uncertainty, stocks like that. So that tends, not always, but usually, to continue. And it continues irregularly. For example, this year, Unlike what's usual, when we had President Biden decide in July that he wasn't going to run for re-election, that immediately increased uncertainty. It wasn't 100% clear that Kamala Harris, the vice president, would become the presidential nominee. Yeah. That was decided pretty quickly. But it wasn't 100% clear that would happen. And then what would she actually do? How would she campaign? All the uncertainty around that. But all of that uncertainty has by now faded away. We have a pretty good sense of how this race is. And so then you get to the next year. And inaugural years are interesting because mostly in America, people tend to believe that the Republican, whoever he is, in this case Donald Trump, but whoever, tends to be more pro-business, more pro-free market, more anti-big government, more anti-regulation. They tend to believe the Democrat is more in favor of regulation, in favor of government programs and big government, and more anti-business, anti-capitalistic, anti-market. The reality of that, going back to the point that people tend to think that if their side loses, it's going to be just terrible. People have high hopes for a Republican victor, and they have high fears of a Democratic victor. But both sides forget that the president is not a king, or maybe a queen in this case.
Yeah.
The president has to deal with a Congress. The Congress tends to not want to give the president everything that the president wants. And whoever the president is, he or maybe she tends to be able to do a lot less than some people hope and other people fear. Mm-hmm. In the inaugural year, if the Democrats elected, they find out the Democrat can't do nearly as much bad as they feared the Democrat might do. If the Republicans elected, they find out the Republican can't do all the good things that they thought that the Republican might do.
Yes.
And so the history of inaugural years are actually better when Democrats are elected because the surprise is positive that they're not as bad as was feared might happen. Mm. When Republicans are elected in the inaugural year, returns typically aren't as good, not perfectly so, but pretty much. Because people are disappointed that that Republican president can't do much. All of that is almost certainly going to be true this time because it doesn't really matter exactly how the congressional elections come out. It's very certain that neither side will have overwhelming power in Congress. It's going to be very hard for a President Trump or a President Harris
to get
very much through Congress. This is going to be the Congress that convenes next year for 2 years is going to not be a do nothing Congress, but it's going to be a do very, very little Congress. Mm-hmm. And that's going to take away a lot of the power of the president to get very much done that some people hope for and other people fear.
So you can say it's always a lot of sound. And at the end of the day, easy to say, it doesn't matter who runs the Oval Office. In a case, world goes round and so does the economy.
So let me argue against that a little bit. If it was a different election than we're going to have this time, where one side won the presidency, big margins in the United States Senate, and big margins in the U.S. House of Representatives, that would be different because then they could move a lot of legislation and create a lot of change. But that isn't this time, and that isn't most times.
Yes.
That does happen, though, but that's not what's going to happen this time. In this case, and you know, Germans know very well that the United States has an upper and lower chamber in its Congress.
Yeah.
In the upper chamber, the Democrats have the Congress currently by one seat.
Yeah.
The Republicans will win the Senate in this election, but they won't win it by much. They might have it by one or three seats at most.
Yeah.
And therefore, if President Trump's elected and not all Republicans agree on things, it's going to be hard to get much through. The Democrats might win the House of Representatives, but if they do, they'll only win it by a few seats. The Republicans might actually gain a few seats and keep the House of Representatives, but they right now only have a tiny margin and they have a very hard time getting anything through. And most of the bills that have gone through have had to be done in cooperation with the Democrats, which means that the Republicans don't really get all of what they want. And even if the Republicans pick up a few seats, that will remain to be true starting next year.
So it is like a little bit like a non-event from a perspective, economic and stock perspective. There's a lot of sound in front over the last couple of months because they are potentially so different. You have Donald Trump with all these tax on imports thing and different, I don't know, view on geopolitical things like that, I would say. But at the end of the day, it's like a non-event.
In this election, pretty much.
It's always great to hear. It's a lot of discussion for, I don't know, nothing. Yeah.
Well, mind you, let me put that a different way.
Yeah.
What I've been talking about is the political impact on how markets will behave.
Yes.
For other features, there is import to all of these elections. Yeah. But they're more social and cultural, not so much economic and market.
Yeah.
And things can be very important to people that have nothing to do with markets or economics or business.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing we talked a lot last time was, of course, it was the end of 2023 and everyone was talking about central banks. When would the Fed cut rates and how often do they cut the rates and European and Bank of England? And you've said central bankers are just crazy.
Yeah.
And
I think that might have been a kinder way to say it than the way I said it.
Of course. But do you think they are gotten a bit more mental healthier over the year?
No. Sometimes crazy people sound like they're not crazy.
Yes, that's true. So it stands that people too much have a look on central bankers and what they possibly do in the next couple of months.
People misunderstand, in my opinion. Central banks and the central bankers that run them, whether it's the Eurobank or the U.S. Federal Reserve, the Bank of Japan, Bank of England, all of them, except for the ones that just simply link their currency to some other currency and take their hands off the steering wheel, people think they have power they don't have. Central banks mostly react. They don't mostly anticipate or cause. You hear this currently from the European central bankers in the degree to which they keep talking about looking, waiting for the data. Also, as I would have said last December, routinely, they don't have any idea what they're actually going to do. And I point out that in 2022, U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said the month before they did a 75 basis point, 0.75% interest rate hike, that we are not even considering a 0.75% interest rate hike. That was in May of 2022. In June, they did that. And then in three of the next 4 months, they did it again.
Yeah.
I don't believe that the man's a liar. I believe he didn't know what he was going to do.
Yeah.
And if they don't know what they're going to do, why do you put a lot of time into trying to anticipate what they're going to do? And then let me point out that both the U.S. Federal Reserve and the Eurobank, the Bank of England, all raised rates steadily, 22 and 3.
Yeah.
And before there had been a single rate cut, starting with the Eurobank this summer.
Yeah.
Global markets around the world had gone through the roof in a bull market. We didn't have a global recession that everybody thought we would have. If all of those rate hikes in all of those places did not do that and the stock markets went up so much, what makes you believe that what these people do is so all-powerful?
But why is everyone looking or interpreting or reacting on what they say and what they do, mostly what they say?
Because people intuitively believe that interest rate movements are more powerful than they actually are. The reason in theory for the reason in theory for a central bank to do these things is more complicated than the common person thinks about. The theoretical reason is that if I raise short-term interest rates relative to long-term interest rates, that disincentivizes banks from using short-term deposits to make long-term loans. Long-term loans are predicated off of long-term interest rates. And if I shrink the spread between the cost of money in the short term and the return that a bank, that a lender can receive from lending long-term money, it's less profitable to make a long-term loan based on short-term deposits. So they'll do less of it. And if they do less of it, then supposedly that will slow down the economy. Mm-hmm. The part that people forget or miss is that short-term overnight lending rate isn't necessarily the cost of the bank's deposit base. Mm-hmm. And in this last cycle, for example, and I've written about this in Focus Money, the cost of the deposit base hardly went up at all because people just kept putting deposits into the banks, all in the aftermath of COVID and the fear of that. So as the official rate was raised by the central bank, the banks, the actual operating banks, the three pillars in Japan, Germany, for example, are just the public and private banks in a place like America. The cost of the deposit base hardly went up at all. So they still had the same profitability to lend. It only changed a little bit. So business didn't stop. Yeah. People assign in their mind more power to what they see as these official interest rate movements than the interest rate movements really have.
Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, there are a lot of people, when we look to what – this first rate cut of the Fed with not the small one, so it was the bigger one. And then they all say, wow, now they are not anymore behind the curve. They are in front. Do you agree with this?
Let me go back to what I said a moment ago. Yeah. Interest rate fluctuations are not as powerful as people think they are. Yeah. It's a little factor. It's not a big factor. People think it's a big factor. It's a mistake to think the way most people think. Mm-hmm. Central banks are not as powerful as people think they are. They don't dictate where markets are going to go. They don't dictate where economies are going to go. And for the most part, I can go on and on about criticizing the way central banks operate and think, but they tend to think in groupthink. Groupthink tends to not work very well. Groupthink tends to get pre-priced in the market. Mm-hmm. And again, what really matters is what goes on with bank lending, mm-hmm. not what goes on with the cost of the money.
Yeah.
Let me just take that a different way.
Yes.
Let's say you're a borrower and you've got a valid reason to borrow money. Forget about what the valid reason. If you're an appropriate borrower and you've got a valid reason to borrow the money, is it really going to make any difference to you whether it's a quarter point higher or lower?
No, of course not.
Exactly. That's my point. It's a little thing. It's not a big thing.
I get my money other ways. Yeah. Or exactly. My margin. Yeah. That's at the end of the day. So at the end of the day, just to make it a – bring it to the end. Forget about all speculations of where they end, I don't know, next year with this Fed fund rates.
With the central banks, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. It's a fool's game to think you're going to outthink that.
Mm-hmm. Great. The other thing we also talked a lot was, of course, it's always the same, every year the same, circuit, is the quality of macro forecasts and how the quality of them are, and how often they are not really right. We have talked about it last year and the year before, and it was always right that they are mostly wrong.
Wrong.
And over the year, we have seen everything all over the place, from small landing, soft landing, to no landing, to, oh, maybe there is a recession just for a couple of days in August, to now, who cares? Markets want to be higher. Is that the case for the next year also?
So let me just step back for a second. In the 1990s, I developed this framework that I started using then publicly, and I've used ever since, that says that professional forecasters, because they've been trained, tend to have too much confidence in what they've been trained in. And if you can figure out what they agree will occur in the marketplace, you don't know what will or won't happen. You don't know what will happen, but you know that what they agree on won't, because that's what's been priced into the market already. So if you think of a normal population distribution, a Gaussian distribution, Gaussian coming from Germany, of course, at some point. Gauss's picture used to be on the mark, if you remember.
Right.
On the back of the mark, there was a little picture of Gauss. If you think of that bell curve, the middle of that bell curve of professional forecasters' forecasts tends to be wrong fully a year out. I figured that out in the 90s. It's been true consistently. That's exactly what we talked about last December. The actual market outcomes could come out better or worse, a little or a lot. Stocks are volatile, so it could be extreme. But the reality is, if they all say it's going to be up 10, you know, bracketing from like 7 to 15, well, it might be up 25 and it might be down 5. But it's not going to be the middle of that bell curve. And but we only really get a lot of those forecasts in December, and we're not to December yet. So I can't tell you at this moment about 2025 in that way. The reality is, when we spoke in December, we already had those when we spoke last December. So the outcome of that, is I do believe that that methodology will tell us a lot about what won't happen in 2025. And then you have to figure out, based on circumstances, what do you think most logically of the other possibilities is really to occur?
But what would you, from today, if we want to look to 2025, what year can this be? Do you think is a year with moderate growth in the US, a better world economic growth, maybe?
So let me paint that picture a little bit. Subject to my changing my mind in December when I see all those forecasts.
Yes, of course.
The stock market is a leading indicator. Germans don't think so well of Germany right now. They think the economy in Germany is terrible. You know all that. But the future for Germany is better than people think it is. And you know that that's true because we've kept hitting new all-time highs in the German stock market. If that were not true, I mean, the stock market is a forecaster of what the economy will be getting better or getting worse, sort of 6 to 12 months into the future. That same principle is true of the United States. Because the global stock market has been so strong, and as we speak, we just hit all-time highs in the global stock market last week. We know we don't have global recession immediately ahead. The economy is going to improve in Germany over the next 6, 12 months. After that, remember, the stock market will keep leading. Now, let me make a point. Let me make a point that some people will use repetitively to deride the stock market. They'll say something like, Well, the stock market has predicted 8 of the last 5 recessions, criticizing the stock market because it goes down sometimes when you don't get a recession, like happened in 2022.
Yeah.
And that's true. That is absolutely true. But the fact of the matter is, when the stock market's been going up on a global basis, you have never, ever, ever had a global recession.
Yeah.
On the upside, it's got a perfect history. And most people just can't get that in their brain, yes, that the global bull market hitting all-time highs tells you the global economy isn't going to be bad immediately ahead. Now, it could be that 6 months from now, mm-hmm, the stock market starts going down, telling you about what would be happening to the economy maybe in 2026,
yeah,
right? The stock market is a leading indicator. It's not a current indicator. And my sense, however, is I don't think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
What I think is going to happen, going back to a line that I have used forever and ever, which is that John Templeton said, bull markets are born on pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, die of euphoria. Almost every time I'm interviewed, I always have to run out John Templeton's quote. I say, where are we now? And where we are now, going back to all of the things that you talked about just a few minutes ago,
yeah,
first they thought this, then they thought the other. Was it going to be a hard landing? Was it going to be no landing? Maybe just a little bit of recession. All of that is telling you that we're not overly optimistic, that we're not euphoric.
Yeah.
And we haven't had, for example, a huge volume of initial public offerings. We haven't had a huge volume of M&A deals.
Yep.
All of those things usually appear in volume during the euphoric period. Sometimes bull markets peak with a little more euphoria and sometimes with a little less. But sentiment warms throughout the course of a bull market irregularly.
Yep.
And there's the other legendary phrase, which is that bull markets love to climb a wall of worry. And they climb the wall of worry until we start to run out of worries, which is when you hit euphoria.
Yeah.
And we're not there yet. So I believe the bull market probably continues.
To get more in this euphoria
until
levels.
We get much more warmed sentiment.
Yeah.
And probably the irregular course of the market has volatility built into it, bounces around all the time.
Yeah.
But probably the first half to two-thirds of 2025 are a continuation of this bull market because we still haven't gotten to that bubbly euphoria, that very warm sentiment where as soon as you say something negative potentially about the economy, people dismiss it.
Yeah.
We're still looking – and I think part of that, Peter, is – COVID was such an unusual experience for anyone.
Yeah.
It scared people so badly because it had absolute mortality risk, not just financial risk.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so different that after it, we've had a very long time. Remember now, that's 4 years ago, a little over 4 years ago that first broke. We've had a very hard time getting back to seeing the world as pretty normal.
Yeah.
If you look at forecasts for global GDP growth, which I don't particularly believe, because I don't particularly believe in any of those forecasts like we've talked about before.
Yes. Yeah.
Forecasts now are in a range that historically is very normal.
Mm-hmm.
Inflation rates are at a very normal level now. Inflation rate, not the past few years. And yet people can't quite accept normal as normal. They keep looking for what's abnormal and thinking that there's got to be some strange thing around the corner somewhere. And the reality is it's actually an increasingly normal time. And when that hits and people come to accept that, I think that's where you get the euphoria.
So normal is normal. Good. That's
normal. Normally is good, but we haven't quite gotten to accept normalcy just recently.
Does this mean, at the end of the day, it is maybe for investors an idea always to look about when we see the last couple of months, what everybody is talking about, if they are all talking about, unemployment rates. Oh, they're a little bit over and under, just a little bit here, a little bit there. Non-farm payrolls, a little bit here, a little bit there. 0.1 above or under estimates. That means, on the other side, as long as everybody is talking about this, we are not in euphoria.
Yeah, let me put. I think
that's in, right. In a right. way, is it like this?
Yes, because
as long as we're talking about these crazy little daily, I don't want to use this word with S. That means that we are not in euphoria.
Yeah. So let me put that a different way because that's right.
Yeah.
Those things you cited, the unemployment number, or are actually numbers that aren't that accurate to begin with.
Health of consumer.
So trying to make a big deal over a little change in a thing that's not very accurate in the first place is silly to begin with.
Yeah.
Secondarily, that feature that you cited, which was very widespread in discussion about the unemployment rate, let me just make a simple point. It's a simple point that's always been true. It's a simple point that I knew when I was 20 years old. Because it was true then, it's true now. Employment is always a lagging indicator. It's not a leading indicator of anything. And therefore, if you take something that, again, employment numbers are not very accurate, you get a little change in a not very accurate thing about something that anyway is a lagging indicator. And you get people all upset about that. Fear of a false factor is always bullish. It's always a bullish feature. Let me just say that again. It is always true. The fact that there's fear of a false factor doesn't mean stocks will go up, but fear of a false factor is always a bullish factor because in the end, the surprise is that false negative didn't really be there. So you get a positive surprise down the road.
So then, as we said, as long as everybody discuss old indicators, everything is okay, I would say.
I wouldn't go as far as everything, but the things that relate to sentiment in the market.
In the market, yeah. Obviously.
Let me just say that intuitively, we all know, you know, I'm an American, you're German. Yeah. Both of our countries have a lot of problems.
Of course.
And there's a lot of things wrong with the world. And none of this has anything to do with that.
Yeah.
But the stock market's already taken all those things into consideration. We're just talking about the stock market here.
Yeah. What would you say are the bigger risks for the next couple of months for the stock market? You have to, I don't know, have a look on it.
So one big fear that we should be always paying attention to is the concern that somehow, some way, out of the totalitarian world, something extreme happens.
Yeah, of course.
I have articulated this before, written about it in Focus Money. I'm particularly concerned about things that are in the triangle of China, India, and Pakistan. So far, that's been benign, but that's a powder keg that could blow. Secondarily, I do believe that there's an awful lot of what I would view as money that's been misplaced in ways that at some point in time unwind, and I can't know when. That's why it's a risk. If you take an awful lot of the money that's been spent into projects aimed at alternative energy and greenness, most of that's money down a rat hole.
Mm-hmm.
If
that's a very German thing. We have done this very much.
But not just. Yeah. It is German, but not just. Yeah. It's a very European thing also.
Yeah.
And the reality is the physics of that are wrong. The fact is, while we build alternative energy capacity, whether it's wind or solar or whatever, the physics make that not economic. And we're going to be dependent on fossil fuels a lot longer than anybody ever thought we would.
Yeah.
And just generally, you know, you and probably almost everyone in Germany knows that Germany's energy policies have not been very good for Germany. And the fact is, the investment in electric vehicles is the same thing. It's all predicated on the concept of needing to do something about climate. And yet these things don't work economically. The physics is wrong for them, and it's been wrong from the beginning. And governments have put a lot of money into that. And at some and governments do all these stupid things, like, you know, trying to treat airports like they're businesses, like subsidizing so many things that they don't know. So let me paint a different picture. And you and I have talked about this a little bit.
Yes.
If you look at the very largest stocks in Europe, none of them are young. If you take the 25 largest European stocks, none of them are younger than 50 years old. The youngest one is SAP at 52. Yeah. If you look at the 25 largest American stocks, two-thirds of them are younger than 50 years old, and a number of them are under 20 years old. That part of newly created, doing never yet done things that change the world also causes a lot of bankruptcies, because when they create the new thing that changes the world, it takes business away from somebody else that had business before. If you look at the world that way, in that framework, and you think of the 40 largest stocks in the world, I come into this world in the 1970s. If you look at every 10 years from then on, after 30 years, three quarters of the largest stocks are no longer among the largest, and half of those have been decimated. When I started out, and you looked at the largest stocks in 1970, they included names like Eastman Kodak, Polaroid, Xerox. They all got decimated. Eastman Kodak and Polaroid got decimated by things like smartphones with, you know,
digital photography.
With digital photography. It also included names like IBM and IBM's still around.
But not that.
But
it's not Big Blue anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's not dominant. It used to be the largest stock in the world.
Yes.
And that is always true. That will be true. The hunter gets successful and big, then gets bureaucratic and lazy and sloppy, and some upstart hunter comes along and figures out how to eat their lunch.
As Schumpeter ever said it.
Exactly. It's Schumpeter's creative destruction.
Yeah.
And that creative destruction is not much appreciated in Europe.
No. And we talked about it before this interview. Yeah.
That the notion that you can have some job loss, which is painful.
Of course, yeah.
Dislocation of people's employment, which is painful. The reality of all of this is that, on the other hand, what moves the world forward is the creation of never yet done things and services that are better for people, and they change the world. And in reality, and this is the part that people miss, that is captured in the stock market. That's one of the basic reasons to own stocks, that you own that part. Now you have to figure out, when is this thing that's been changing the world stopping changing the world and getting too old and too bureaucratic. But that process is what pushes all material improvement for humanity forward, not some stupid policy that the government comes up with to, instead of letting things happen in the private sector, you know, let's invest a lot of money in something that won't go anywhere.
The problem is, I think, with these governmental investments like EV or this transformation, it's not based, as you said, the physics are wrong. It's more like based on hope.
Yes.
And on the hope that that we can change physics. What is really stupid, but...
And the way they think it should be, rather than the way it is.
Yeah. And that's what the future normally not brings to you. But do you also, if you say one of the fear thing is that money gets the wrong directions in a big way, like EV or all these energy things?
At some point in time, you could have a political movement that recognizes the stupidity of what had happened before, doesn't want to pay for it, wants to blame the prior politicians to elevate themselves. And then those entities go down, and with that, all at once, and particularly in a European cascading effect, that creates a panic. And that could happen at any time.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, in America, one benefit of the strange election system that we have is we only have elections when we have them. There's a presidential election every 4 years, midterm election in between. You know exactly when it'll happen. The presidential election, the midterm always happen in the first week in November. You know exactly when it'll be. It's always on a Tuesday. And the reality is, in Europe, you can have these elections popping up out of nothing.
That's right, yeah.
And so therefore, they can cascade. And so there is a risk there. I don't see anything about that's happening now, but there's a risk there.
Yeah, there's a risk is in Germany, I would say. There's a risk for changing the dates of when we have election. That's at the moment very possible. But yeah, we will see. But do you think, is there also a risk when we talk about the wrong invested money in a too big way, that this could be happen to AI, where we have a lot of euphoria? Of course, it would change the world. We are all fine with that. But if you see how much everyone is investing, and some people say, I don't know if and in how way I ever get any return of this investment, but I have to invest.
So AI will be real. Excuse me. AI will be real, but AI will take a lot longer than people think it will.
Yeah, that's also my opinion.
The reality of AI is it requires effective rebuilding of the core systems that we use in computing, and that takes a long time.
Yeah.
The implementation of AI requires the development of algorithms that then have to be refined and refined and refined and refined before it can do anything important. Let me paint that picture a slightly different way. If you think about using AI in two different ways, you see the time frame involved. The one way is to do, which is good, the elimination by machine of otherwise laborious human processes that are repetitive. Things that could be thought of otherwise as clerical work. That, of course, saves money, is efficient, helps productivity, and is good. If you think of using AI to do something that requires what people otherwise think of as thinking, because the former isn't really much different than what a robot would do. But if you wanted to do something new and different and creative, now you got to have the risk that the algorithm isn't actually right and it does something that is negative, not positive. And it takes a long time to work it and work it and work it and work it. And still all of this is the algorithm because it doesn't actually think.
Yeah.
It just acts as if it seems to think. That all takes a long time. This is going to be a longer function. But the concentrated effort in AI in a big way is in bigger companies. The emphasis on NVIDIA is real because NVIDIA sells the chips that it takes to rebuild the computer system globally. That'll take a long time, be a lot of sales for NVIDIA along the way. But the notion that some program we're going to be using next year is going to change the way we do everything is a slow trickle. Mm. Is it going to happen? Yes, it'll happen. But it's not going to come that fast, and there is disappointment that can coming from that. It won't slow down the process of rebuilding that computer system for the long term. But it will run the risk that a lot of the little entities that are trying to come up with something that you could use as a consumer next year to change your life, that's not happening.
And you have, if you look from the from investment side, the risk, short or more midterm, that the, I don't know, top companies that brings the next evolution level that is good for everyone, not just NVIDIA, changes maybe every, I don't know, 2 or 3 years because everybody is in this market on the way.
On the other hand, if you think about those companies, the risks there relative to the size of the companies are not very big. You're talking about Microsoft, you're talking about Google, you know. These are measured bets. And even if they are not working very well, it's a small activity relative to the scale of those large entities.
Mm. Coming from the
As I said, another way.
Yeah.
If you're the size of Microsoft, you're the size of Google or Amazon, you ought to be making a lot of big bets of some kind. Otherwise, you can't. Otherwise, you can't keep pushing the world.
Yeah, and you are not Microsoft anymore. You are like Eastman Kodak or
there you go.
So from the longer perspective, more to the shorter midterms, are you already bullish on big tech?
Am I already bullish on – I've been bullish on big tech all along.
Yeah. And I
mean, the reality is that we had a period in the summer where – tech lagged and value stocks did better than growth stocks. But let me make the point that during that same period, there was the market going sideways for a while.
Yeah.
A point that I make that no one seems to talk about is that on any given day, if the global market is up markedly, tech is up more. Mm. If it's down markedly, tech is down more.
Yeah.
It's directional. If you believe that we're in a continued bull market, tech's going to keep doing better than the market as a whole.
Okay.
It may not be the very hottest part, but it'll keep doing better. Every time the market's up big on a day, tech's up more. Market's down big in a day, tech's down more.
So,
if you think the market's going to go down, you don't want to own tech.
No, of course. It's like
it's just directional.
Do you think or is it a field that this sometime in the market will change?
Yes, sometime it will, but I don't know when.
I don't know. We are looking to valuations and everybody says, that was fine and now it's not fine anymore.
So I'm going to disagree there.
Yeah.
Valuations are never predictive.
Yeah.
I don't care how you slice it. Yeah. On a 1, 3, and 5 year basis, valuations don't tell you where anything's going. It is so strongly embedded in people's thinking that they do, that they can't get away from that. But we have a very, very, very long history of price and valuation measure by every type, PE, price to book, price to sales, dividend yield, price to EBITDA, you go on and on and on, and you cannot find any of them that have any ability to predict what will happen a year or 3 years later.
Yeah.
And therefore, people that keep saying, well, the valuations are this, from every valuation level, looking out 1 year, there's the same amount of up in frequency as they are down by amount. It's a random coin toss. So it, valuation won't do it. But I, we will come to an end of this bull market. We will come to a period where there'll be a normal bear market with a recession. One of my fears is the whole purpose of a recession in the first place is to clean out the excesses of the past expansion to build a base for the next level of economic expansion.
Yeah.
And it has been a long time since we fully cleaned house. COVID made us clean house some, but we didn't have the recession. Yeah. And because we didn't have the recession, we didn't clean house fully. And when it comes time eventually where we get to that point, there'll still be a lot of house cleaning to do, which might be, for example, when that feature that I mentioned about the European investment in profitless, uneconomic activities might come home to roost, but might not. But for sure in the corporate sector, we didn't get the full house cleaning. COVID scared people. So there was some cleaning up done. But we didn't get the full scale because we didn't have the recession that went with it. We had an economic contraction that was very short, induced by government shutting down the economy. But other than that, we didn't get the normal stuff.
But would you agree, and that's not maybe the a good thing, that the Western world, the bigger states are not willing anymore to much clean really the house?
Oh, no, it's the private sector. It's the private sector that'll clean the house.
Because you have always governments that put so much money on the table that you don't go into a recession, like the U.S. with deficits in normal times, like deficits in World War phases. And it not stops because nobody wants a recession. Like
we will have a recession again. We will have recession again. The government can't stop a recession.
Yeah.
The government, if you remember me saying that the central bankers are crazy, heaven help you with Congress or a parliament.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
By the time they'll recognize that it happened, you'll already be in it.
Are you a little bit worried about the deficits U.S. likely is working with, and there is no end of it, and we have growing debt, also relatively maybe to GDP, in some point or
so. German,
who cares?
Germans.
It's a German thing, very much.
But let me just say this really simply.
Yeah.
And when I say this, there's probably some of your listeners that are going to immediately turn off the rest of the podcast.
I don't think so, but yeah.
America has a lot less debt than it used to have. Less debt than it used to have.
Okay.
People just don't know that. Let me take you through that.
Mm-hmm.
What happens? Well, debt is issued in a given year in currency. In the case of U.S. debt, dollars in a given year.
Yeah.
The next year, you have another deficit, you get some more debt. The next year, you have another deficit, you get some more debt. The next year, you get another deficit, you get some more debt. Fair enough?
Yeah.
We get to 2021, and we run into 2021, 2023, where we get about 20% inflation. Mm-hmm. That took all the cumulative debt up to that point in time and made the money worth 20% less. Now, with a little time lag, no more than a year, government revenue comes in current dollars because government revenue comes in basically derived off of income tax from income, which is in current dollars.
Yeah.
So the government revenue is in the inflated number, whereas the debt has been devalued by the inflation by about 20%.
Yeah.
Now, stop and think about it. There's a lot of idiots in America that are terrified because this year we'll have one of the three biggest deficits in America we've ever had at $1.8 trillion.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question that's a lot of people ask, but they never pursue it. Why do central banks want the inflation to be 2%? What's good about 2%? I mean, why not 4% or no percent? What about, I mean, a German would like the idea.
Normally you have to say stabilization isn't is zero. Yeah, you would normally.
So let's think that through. All of that cumulative debt in America right now, which just got decreased by 20% from the inflation, is in what we now call in our dollars today, 35 trillion U.S.
Yeah.
2% inflation on 35 trillion U.S. wipes out $750 billion of it in the next year, which is $750 billion of the 1.8 trillion. You follow that?
Yeah.
America has a $28 trillion GDP that's going to grow at about 2.8% this year. That equalizes the rest of it, the rest of the 1.8. That's why the math works. People don't get this. The fact of the matter is, on an inflation-adjusted basis, the magnitude of the debt that would be repaid, which would probably never get repaid, is significantly less than it used to be because inflation, unless you have a Weimar Republic-type phenomena, is always the friend of government.
Yeah.
Inflation is really horrendous for the people that have no income.
Yeah.
It's very bad for the people that are on fixed income. If you're actually on neither, you're a working person, it's tough on you until your wages go up. But when I was very young, Milton Friedman proved, and nobody believes it, but it's always been true. There is no such thing as wage push inflation. Inflation happens first, then wages follow. Always. If inflation goes down, wage growth falls after. It's no more than a year. But the reality, if you're working, the inflation comes along, you don't, your wage doesn't go up immediately. But then about a year later, your wage is caught up with the inflation and it's only hurt you temporarily and then you go on with life. But it's the friend of government. It's always the friend of government. It decreases the value of that cumulative debt and that wall of inflation that the central bankers created. They do that so that the debt won't be unmanageable. That's why. It's so simple. And that 2% inflation wipes out about half of the annual deficit value every year.
Do you understand the German debate about not having new debt, new deficits?
No, not at all.
So we are the only, I don't know, country in the world where we're this strict.
Why is that good?
I have no idea. I'm not on this side of the of this debate.
It's inconsistent with finance theory in that – it's just a trade-off.
It don't make sense, especially in Europe where we have this one currency with a lot of countries and everybody else is doing a different kind of debt.
And the Eurobank allowed for the inflation too.
So it is.
So really Germany pays a price there.
Let's come just a little bit back to the stock markets. We have talked, I think, last year, of course, about it at this big tech rally, but now a really good year. The spreads between big growth and the rest of the market, I would say, value, mid-cap, small-caps, it didn't really get that much closer.
Right.
Do you think next year is a year where you have maybe a little bit more mid-caps, small-caps, if they are in quality, if you look like sector-wise and at value? Is there a relative comeback?
So in Germany, you can see the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, in the German market, the big stocks have done better this year than the
it's
smaller stocks.
Much more extremer than in the US, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And
but there are reasons because they are more on the industrial side.
Yes.
Or production side, I would say.
But in America,
it's significantly that the dominance of the growth comes from the biggest companies.
Yeah.
And the dominance of that growth has overwhelmingly been the big tech in the names that you know. But it is also true, and I've said this for a long time, that if you go through the process of a normal bull market, you know, we talked before about born on pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, die on euphoria. In the beginning of a new bull market, people have been scared to death by a bad economy and bad things and fears around every corner. And so the people that are prepared to buy and own stocks are ones who are, if you will, courageous enough to do it in that environment.
Yeah.
People who aren't courageous enough to do it in that environment aren't going to own stocks.
Yeah.
By the time you get to sentiment warming in the latter parts of a bull market, you now have people coming into the market buying stocks that weren't courageous enough to do it before.
Yeah.
And the moment they're doing that, they're typically not wanting to buy the most speculative stocks or little stocks. They want to buy stocks that, because they were just too afraid to own anything a moment before, that they're comfortable will be there if the market doesn't do well.
Yeah.
Big, stable names. The big, stable names that have been there, have good market share, have a big customer base, are very visible. They've heard the names for a long time. They know the names. The new buyer in the latter stages of the bull market biases toward pushing up big.
Yeah.
People say, and they've been wrong, that this period is like the tech bubble of 2000. That's wrong for some basic fundamental reasons. We come back to that if you want. But if you think of the tech bubble, of course, it occurred at the end of a bull market.
Yeah.
If you think of, you know, many of your listeners may be too young to have known this world, but I remember it very well. In the early 1970s, leading up to the 1972 peak, you had what were called the Nifty 50.
Yeah.
And the Nifty 50 were all big growth. It is that world, typically high quality, big names that get that last money in a bull market as it's about to go over the peak and early on into the next bear market. And that is typical behavior of that part of the cycle. So I don't expect, as we come to the latter portions of the bull market, to see more smaller speculative stocks overwhelmingly taking over. I don't think that happens.
So now we have maybe seen it now, the segments, smaller, bigger, speculative. What do you think about a China comeback stock-wise? Is that a very big thing? It don't look like they had put on the whatever it takes, big bazooka. Or do you think you have Chinese stocks need in your portfolio?
I think China is toast.
Yeah.
Let me make a couple points about China. China went through a period. The era evolved through Deng Xiaoping of liberalizing its economy.
Yeah.
Chairman Mao had said, stay out. Deng Xiaoping said, come in.
Yeah.
President Xi has become a dictator.
Yeah.
Running a top-down economy based on values that are not centralized around free markets.
Yeah.
I make a point. You can take out some little device like my iPhone, and you can call up the stock market and look at all kind of indexes.
Yeah.
And then you can look at someone like China. I've got the for your convenience, I put an airplane mode and I put it back onto regular.
Yeah.
And you get the Chinese market, and then you put it on all, and you go back and you see that
the Chinese market has made no net advance since Xi came to power.
Yeah.
None. That's telling you something. People don't believe in capital markets the way I believe in capital markets. Capital markets are truth tellers. They're not liars. And the fact of the matter is, said simply, that Xi's dominance as a dictator has returned the world, not completely, but significantly, to be more like what Mao was doing. Xi is quite prepared to subordinate business and free markets. And therefore, you're not going to value the stock market one iota. Mm-hmm. Let me make another point. We can do this a different way. You do the same kind of thing. You can go and you can look up – I got to find it here because it's not the biggest deal in the world. But you go and you look up Hong Kong market and you say to yourself, if you look at Hong Kong, it did great for a really long time.
Yeah.
It did great for a really long time, but right there is where China took over. And it's done lousy since. You cannot treat capital markets with disdain and creative destruction with disdain and not support economic activity being about free will without paying a price for it. China will maintain itself as a big economy. And it has now gotten to a point that Xi likes a lot. Russia is subordinated to China.
Yep.
North Korea is subordinated to China. Iran is on a leash. China is the power behind what George W. Bush, when he was president, was criticized for saying as an axis of evil.
Yep.
But in the same way that Hezbollah and Hamas and the Houthis are all around proxies. Iran itself today has been becoming ever more of a Chinese proxy. And in geopolitics, this matters. In markets, it works against China. If you think of what's gone on with Russia, I mean, Russia has terribly destroyed itself. And the Ukraine war has made that ever more apparent and ever more true. You remember when in Germany people would have had fear that Russia would have rolled right on past Ukraine and into Europe or into the Western Europe. And in reality, past the initial shock at the beginning, they haven't been able to make any progress at all. When you look at – I'm just going to babble at you a little on foreign policy here. But when you look at Iran sending missiles into Israel or Hezbollah sending missiles into Israel, and you note that Israel has a not perfect but almost perfect defense system. Iran doesn't. Lebanon, Hezbollah doesn't. The fact is when Western gear goes up against non-Western gear, the Western gear always wins overwhelmingly because of the technology advantage the West has. Earlier, we were talking about technology. Look at the semiconductor production in China compared to the semiconductor production outside of China. And everything about next generation technology as it comes from semiconductors – integrated circuits, et cetera, all is non-Chinese. Chinese are just tiny, tiny, tiny and not very good at this. And this is one where if you're not the leading edge of it, you're the bleeding edge of it. And the reality is that then speaks to the next few generations of military gear. China's comfortable where it is. She's comfortable where he is with that because he's in a more powerful position than ever in those ways, which allows him to have comfort to not be dealing with a world of commerce that's expansionary for his people, because you know in your bones dictators don't give a darn about their citizens.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, dictators have never given a darn about their citizens.
That's right.
Mostly politicians don't give a darn about their citizens if they know they can be reelected.
Yeah.
But if they're not going to get reelected, suddenly they pay attention to their citizens.
That's right. Because they have nothing to lose anymore. And at the end of the day, it's on every level the same: peace, of course, and freedom, and non-governmental, I don't know, power is the answer to nearly everything. The rest works fine, mostly.
In the end, the most important thing is the creation of never yet done things that are better than what we had before. That is the basis of progress. That only comes from some crazy person thinking up an idea that the guy sitting on top of a big, huge corporation would never have thought of, that everybody would think is ridiculous. Think about when Jeff Bezos, who kind of looks ridiculous these days, with his girlfriend on a monstrous yacht, he doesn't look like a person doing anything that's in the slightest serious.
Yeah.
But when you think of him as a young man with skinny little arms.
We all have seen these pictures.
Thinking to himself and saying to some other people, I'm going to start a business that's going to change everything about book retailing. And then I'm going to go on to change everything about retailing. Yeah. And how are you going to do that? Oh, we're going to sell stuff online. Everybody would have thought he was ridiculous.
Yeah.
But he did it. The reality is, every one of these big, huge companies was started by somebody just like that.
Yeah.
Every one of them. And the reality of that is that part where some crazy person says, here's an idea I can do. You can't predict where it'll strike. You can't predict who will do it. You can't predict exactly where it'll be.
Yeah.
But it keeps happening.
Yeah.
And as long as it keeps happening, that is the answer to progress, because ultimately a customer finds things that are good for them. That doesn't come out of places like China.
Yeah. So stay hungry and look after the people. They stay hungry in the stock market. Ken, this was inspirational. A lot of fun. Thanks.
Thanks for having me
for
back.
For this interview. Great to have you here personal. Always more interesting, of course, than online. But sometimes, as always, technology, sometimes you need the internet. But in personal, it's a lot more fun, I think.
You do a great job interviewing, so it's fun for me.
You're doing a great job. It's easy for me, I have to say. So thank you very much. Guys, ich hoffe, ihr konntet einiges mitnehmen. Ich denke, war ein sehr interessanter Rundumschlag. Vielen Dank fürs Zuschauen. Bis zum nächsten Mal. Ciao.